On this episode of Negative Modifier, we'll be playing the game Deltagreen. Deltagreen is a mature tabletop RPG that tackles various dark and unsettling themes and topics that some listeners may find traumatizing, harmful, or generally uncomfortable. Listener discretion is advised. Hello and welcome to the Negative Modifier cast talks about Lover in the Ice deep dive episode. If this is your first episode of Negative Modifier, please go listen to any of our other episodes that are not labeled deep dives. This is a very bad episode to start with because we are going full spoilers for our playthrough of Lover in the Ice, the module, basically maybe anything else we've played before too, like go pick anything we have with the number one at the start of it or as part of it or part one attached to it and start with that. You're probably better off than this episode. But also, hey, if you want to listen to someone talk about Lover in the Ice and don't care about spoilers for our content, here's a great place to start, I guess. Welcome. Now that we've gotten that out of the way, hi, I'm Charlie, the game master of Negative Modifier for the most part. And I'm joined by the lovely cast of Negative Modifier. Guys, as always, introduce yourselves.
Hi, I am Alex, also known as Mave Online in the gaming or the social media space. And yeah.
What character did you play?
Oh, yeah. Well, I played two characters because my first character died.
Yeah, you did.
So I was Agent Snail. And then I was, what the heck was the officer's name?
Deputy
I can't remember.
Filigree.
There you go. Detective Filigree. But yes, I played two characters. Deputy. That's right. Deputy Filigree. Wasn't a detective. I was a bad cop and not bad in the sense of like, I'm a evil person. I was just kind of shit.
We'll get to that, I guess. Cause I don't think Deputy Filigree's that bad at his job. Like,
he's
comparative.
Yeah.
Relative. It's all relative.
I mean, like, we're getting our head of ourselves because we still have to introduce Jad and Dylan, but, like, dude followed three Delta Green agents in our playthrough, so.
True.
Yeah. Yeah. Anyway, so I talked next, so I guess I'm going to introduce myself. Hey, what's up? My name is Jad. I played Agent Sanguine, your local pharmacy technician, actually plastic surgeon, but you know what? I got a script, and if you got a need, I can fill it. That's not actually what's happening in real life. I am not a medical worker. Please do not come to me for medical advice. I just watched a lot of House.
We will get into that, because that was the number one thing we kept getting asked through all of Lover in the Ice was, does Jad work in some type of medical field? And I kept telling people, no.
I got a script, and if you got a need, I can fill it. It's such a Tinder line, by the way.
Dylan, get us back on track, please.
Yes. Hi, I'm Dylan. I played Agent Star. He was the guy that was basically an asshole through the whole thing and ran around with a chainsaw.
Yes, welcome. Apparently this deep dive is going to be a tad unhinged, which makes sense for Lover in the Ice, I suppose. Like, coming off that one, I think we're all a little punchy and giddy because it starts off one way and ends absolutely differently, I think. The general synopsis, I think we'd all apply to it. Yes.
I'm really just realizing the fact that our straight shooter was just this person running around a small town with a chainsaw. It's really just like settling onto me right now.
Let's just get to the dumb Limp Bizkit jokes that killed me. I could not make the entire time that shit was going down. Yes. The amount of chainsaw jokes that are uselessly wired into my brain that I'm just like, nope, we can't make any of these. A, because some of them are Limp Bizkit jokes. B, because like they're just not funny to anyone but me. Yeah, if there's great joy in my life that I finally got to put a chainsaw in something we've done because. And like this was brought up, I think, in the comments of one of the videos at one point on YouTube. Yes, I'm aware chainsaws are bad melee weapons. I've seen all the videos of how quickly they jam. It does not make the idea of someone fighting an unnatural creature with a chainsaw any less cool.
Listen, they're just doing it wrong, okay?
Yeah.
I love the fact that you're also fighting things that are like 3 feet tall. you're just smattering little monkey leech babies, basically just busting out of people's chests.
Okay, so let's get into this, actually.
Okay, yeah,
this is the most important thing I want to talk about for this, because we will have a more serious conversation about Lover in the Ice as we kind of wind down on this some. But I love this operation for us because it is the epitome of operation successfully achieved, only with like 70% understanding of what the hell is going on. There was a meme that made the rounds a couple years ago of making fun of basically Death Note, where it was like, could solve Death Note, could figure out the mechanics of Death Note, but not solve the murders, could do both and couldn't achieve both. And like, you guys were square in the like, figured it out, solved the situation, never quite figured out what actually the mechanisms for all this stuff was. And it was fascinating watching kind of you perpetuate your own understanding of what was going on with these things. That was like 75% accurate. You got the important details of it, but like, it was wrong. And based on what you guys uncovered, kind of evidence wise and information wise, you had the exact understanding you'd come to off that. You just never went down a certain path, but also going down that path results in there being more of these damn things to fight, which I thought was just absolutely fascinating to watch play out, because I think kind of like the running theory was that like snake serpent things go into a person, gestate, then bust out of the person as a monkey thing. And I think that's kind of about as far as you guys understood the situation. Is that more or less correct?
Yeah, and they really liked violence.
Yeah, so these creatures are called the El Emante. That is, depending on which Google Translate you put that into, it just means the lovers, or the lover in translation. It is an invention for this one and for this operation specifically on its own. I know this because I have spent literally years trying to figure out which one of the kind of mythos things it might have been a reference to, and finally broke down and asked Caleb Stokes, the author of Lover in the Ice, what it was. He said, oh, I just made it up. And I'm like, thank you. I'm angry I didn't ask this sooner, because this has been bugging me for literal years. But at the same time, the fact I could draw so many parallels is something I kind of really enjoyed about this. And it's led to my love of this operation. But so, yeah, let's talk about the Emante real quick. So they are a fascinating creature that I'm going to explain kind of how they work, and then you guys can ask your questions. I think it's going to fill in a bunch of gaps that were kind of existing as we were playing through this. Basically, the snake thing is actually a byproduct of the monkey. So, and the way it works is, snake thing enters a host, and it gets lodged in their throat cavity. It stays there basically indefinitely and influences the human behavior. And it's basically driving you to commit acts of violence. Like, it encourages your body via chemicals and whatnot, and is also feeding off of your blood, and eventually turns you into Skip Mills, and you kill someone. And that whole kind of stabbing thing I kept having to do, where it lunge out of someone's face. It's not explained exactly how it's supposed to work, but basically, if it kills you and injects you with that, the orange fluid is injected into your body, and it turns your dying, dead body basically into an incubation chamber that repurposes all of your mass, basically, and makes a new one of the monkey things, the pink monkeys you were fighting. And that's why that's the kind of the cedar end of things. Basically, the cedar make incubus or incubi, which are the kind of the corpses that essentially act as Emante wounds. And when they get ripe, they explode out and a new Emante comes out of it, and process repeats itself. The cedar does not have a set number of times it can do that. It can kind of do that indefinitely. And more cedars are made. And I think you guys have kind of missed me going on about this a couple times. And again, it's a subtle thing to have missed. The cedar comes out of the Emante's tail. It's basically kind of like a detachable phallus that it implants in victims and has a mild psychic connection. And if the Emante it comes out of is alive, the kind of victim of the cedar, of the kind of implanted organ, acts one way. If it's dead, they act slightly differently. There's a kind of psychic connection there in kind of a primal sense. And the kind of extra delta green layer of this is that it's not so much breeding as it is cloning. Like, the all Amante are technically the same creature on a genetic level. Like the way it works is it just kind of repurposes the human meat and makes a new Amante out of it, and it keeps doing that indefinitely.
Oh, okay.
So, and to kind of like put this into context of how this whole thing works, there was a cedar, the kind of detachable, whatever you want to call it, the implantation thing in the box that was in the green box. It gets into Skip Mills. Skip Mills turns his mom into the first full Amante. The Amante breaks into the girl's apartment building, gets cedars in both of them. They kill their roommate, who is the John Doe you found in the first place. He dies because of cold, not because of cedar attack, but he gets attacked by the cedar. They then lure the repair woman and a homeless person in, turn them both into incubi. They hatch. And basically the way the operation is set up is that like the longer you spend stalling and not dealing with the situation, more incubi are out there. And it becomes kind of a kind of almost a math equation at that point, where it's like there's no set number of how many people a cedar can turn. There's a kind of reload time on the Amante for how many more cedars they can make. But if you're not dealing with the cedars, that's the actual problem, because the cedars can keep making more and more and more Amante that can then in turn make more and more and more cedars, and kind of becomes a self-multiplying problem, which is where kind of what I think is the finale of the operation comes in, which is the, do you go and deal with the Amante at the gym or the cedars at the party? And it kind of forces a party split. And I'm very happy that managed to happen, because you got to experience the kind of horrors of both, where it's like, hey, you're fighting this supernatural monkey thing in a gym full of potential victims. In our case, an actual victim had already happened. Like, it already kind of meshed its cedar into another person. And at the same time, you have possibly the worst situation possible to have not one but two cedars loose in. Like, if you kind of thought about it, like, the number of people that could have possibly become incubi or become incubus and then make more Amante at the college party is a lot, potentially.
Huh. I mean, that totally makes sense, considering it's such a high density of location for that event. Like, that,
and the
that
operation even goes into kind of like, if you guys are, it even makes a point of saying if the agents are too slow getting to the college party, basically, that's what starts happening. Like, the idea is like, yeah, you should show up and maybe be able to save Chad, but like, if they drag their feet and aren't kind of aggressive about it, there are three people infected with cedars loose at that party, and they are just stacking bodies that are infected that are going to hatch in a day or two. And so, and let's get into this, I guess, in a more formal manner. Let's start kind of at the start of this. The storm is a totally natural, normal storm. Like, it's just a tragic ice storm that leads to an unfortunate situation that releases a cedar, and things kind of spiral from there. I guess kind of before we get into the nitty gritty of this, any questions so far on this? Stuff you want to expand upon?
No, I think it's funny that the storm was actually just a natural occurring event that sucks.
Normal ass boring storm.
Yeah, that's just that's kind of a funny situation, a wonderful diversion, if you will.
The predecessor little excursion with Lover in the Ice was Jack Frost. And so the fact that like it just ended up being something so mundane kind of was like, oh, OK, cool. But then again, this was a operation that let us know that, hey, just because it's mundane does not mean it's dangerous.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, no, for sure. I mean, considering what happened to us driving around in the snow, like, definitely is a good reminder that, like, yeah, even though it's a naturally occurring event, you should still respect the naturally occurring events that happen. So that's why we got clapped, or at least my character got clapped.
No, so. It's a big part of why I like Lover of the Ice as much as I do, because I'm not going to say the Amante aren't dangerous. They're a pretty cool threat. They're very interesting, I think, from a handler perspective. This is not a world-ending, end-of-mankind type of situation. This is, I'd liken it more to kind of like a disease outbreak almost. And me being me, you may have noticed that. So one of the kind of early on changes I made about this is kind of just generally set at January. I find it infinitely funnier to set this thing around Valentine's Day because I have a sick sense of humor. And you may have noticed I kind of dropped a mild hint at kind of the slight nature of what was actually going on with this, with the year I picked for this, which may have been too subtle a detail.
Yeah, it was too subtle for me to notice.
February 2020.
Oh, Okay.
In my head, I was just like, oh, cool. This was, like, I remember February 2020. That was just the month where I was like, man, 2020 is going to be fucking baller. I've got all of my shit just like lined up, all these parties lined up for the rest of the year. And then I had to stay inside.
Yep. For those confused, COVID in the US broke out basically the month after. It was already a thing in certain parts of the world prior to that, but it became, it's kind of the end of February, March, where it became like the full global effect, wasn't it, more or less?
Yeah, right around that time.
Yeah, the operation can be set kind of roughly whenever you want. I thought kind of dropping a little hint about like, hey, maybe you should have virus on the brain, or kind of like how viruses spread, or kind of like something about that was a fun little Easter egg to throw in there. Maybe not fun because it's referencing to a horrific tragedy that affected the world, but kind of it speaks to a similar nature to kind of what actually plays out in Lover in the Ice Some, which is kind of it's less Monster Mash cult and more kind of a 3-foot-tall manifestation of essentially a disease in some ways, which I don't know, I find fascinating in its own kind of bizarre way. But yeah, that's enough of kind of some of the early alterations I made and kind of some of the background of this. Yeah, so the storm's totally normal. So there's basically two versions of this. There's the version you guys played through, which is what I think of as the air quotations correct way to play Lover in the Ice, which is we just have to solve this, we have to move. And then there is the significantly slower paced, more methodical. You do some DNA testing on the orange liquid. You spend more time kind of really digging into the science aspects of what's presented, and you get a real sense of what's going on. I don't think it matters that much or really kind of changes up what ultimately winds up happening. In fact, being slow and methodical is rewarded, sarcastic air quotations on that, with way more Amante to deal. Basically, it's set up where, like, okay, once you're in full contact with the Amante, then the storm's over. Like, it's the, you can't leave until setting wise that has to happen, because it's the storm is actually your friend. It's keeping the Amante in the town, basically, because they don't like the cold. And it, I think you guys picked up on this too, actually, where like sound and cold were your best friends because the Amante are blind. They're a little bit smarter than you think at first, but yeah, the cold slows them down and sound makes it much harder for them to kind of keep an eye on you. But yeah, it's a, quite literally the ice storm is containing the monsters for you in a very bizarre kind of accidental, useful way.
Oh.
Despite also murdering basically an agent because of snow.
I kind of figured with like the cold and everything else like that. I mean, weirdly enough, I thought tropical.
Yeah.
And in my head, it's like, all right, cool. I am a tropical individual.
They are from the Amazon basin. You picked up on that either subconsciously or consciously and made the correct decision of, hey, they're probably looking for warmth.
Because I have never seen snow personally. And for the fact that if I were a small tropical demon, I would not want to be out in the snow. And that somehow led into, hey, I got the right idea. Barry, the work was absolutely wrong, but somehow you got the right answer.
Yeah, no, like I said, it was kind of fascinating watch you guys get like enough information to make the correct assumptions. I think the module lends itself very nicely to that approach to Delta Green, where like it's, you can still arrive at more or less the right answer with completely misunderstanding or not fully understanding all of the kind of details that lead you there. And I think that's really cool. I think it kind of speaks to the writing of Lover in the Ice. It's a very subtle kind of like, you can logically track the logic throughout it where it's like, okay, cool. Amazon, tropical, probably not a fan of all this snow shit.
Is Filigree a book character by chance?
Yeah. Okay. So generally speaking, because of the nature of Delta Green, there is an NPC in every single kind of little adventure we go off on for Delta Green. That is my, hey, if someone dies, here's who you slot in. Up to a certain point, like I guess to reference back to some previous stuff, if an agent dies right at the end of an operation, kind of like Father Faustus did, there's A, no need to swap in a new agent, B, there's no time, and C, it undercuts kind of that moment. But like in this case where Agent Snail died, call it 2/3 of the way through Lover in the Ice, kind of right before we got to the big finale, or kind of like right before we got to the finale and ended and entered in kind of the conspiracy and kind of cover-up phase, makes sense to swap Eli in at that point. yeah, he is in the book. He's even recommended as, hey, if someone dies, slot this person as an NPC.
Oh, right on.
Yeah. Or from NPC into a player character. Yeah. And then you get to play up the angle. And I think you guys did a great job of this, of normal local law enforcement having to comprehend with Delta Green asshole behavior.
Which I commend Alex for, yeah, absolutely, because the initial tension of Filigree was so good. And just the kind of separation of Filigree was also just absolutely phenomenal. Because it's like, oh yeah, you're not trying to be buddy-buddy as Sanguine and Star try kind of finish everything up. You're just like, I'm going to get the fuck out of Dodge. You guys fucked up my life real hard.
The episode, I guess it's what, episode 8 or something like that, where Alex took over Filigree and we had the Filigree versus Star showdown, I think is the, you cannot hear it because I cut all my stuff out for it, but I was on mute for a chunk of that, just swearing, just fuck, 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 as I'm frantically making a National Guard character. I was convinced Alex is going to die again.
The dice really played out that fight how how you'd expect it to go.
I apologize for the pun, but I think you guys did a really good job of kind of rolling with it for that entire thing. It was kind of embracing the chaos of, there's a certain beautiful kind of slapstickiness to it.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, come on, let's be honest. When you like fail a roll to like jump over the counter and you end up just kind of stuttering across the way, like it just, yeah, it just, I mean, how do you not slapstick that whole sequence? Like it just made sense.
Indeed.
Funny enough, I was 100% ready to die to like have to either re-roll a character or figure some shit out in that standoff. Because I fully believe that Star would shoot through Sanguine to get through to Filigree, but I did not believe whatsoever that I had the capabilities of saving myself.
I want you to know I was like one more line away from shooting through you.
I figured, but at that time I had just picked up Adapted to Helplessness, so you could totally tell the tonal shifts of Sanguine as I picked up more and more irregularities. What is it? The debilitating mental illnesses?
I mean, adapted to, I guess. We'll call them not so great character traits. But yeah, no, it was that entire sequence was me sitting there being like, oh, this is so cool. Please don't fucking kill another character. Please don't fucking kill another character. I'm not prepared for this. How the hell do I justify two National Guardsmen and Star working together?
So, Lovering the Ice is written as a one-shot, or?
I don't think anything except for PX Poker Night and Last Things Last for Delta Green can really ever be considered as a one-shot. It is, and it's a module for Delta Green. I think it, you can totally run this as a one-shot if you want. I guess in one-shot, my brain implies it is designed to be one session type of thing. Like there are people out there that run a variety of Delta Green modules in one or two sessions, and I don't know how you do that personally. Like, I thought this was going to be like 4 or 5 episodes tops, and 11 episodes later, don't I look wrong? Yeah, I think it's also one of those things where kind of it depends on your group and what they make of it. And I think there's a lot in Delta Green that plays towards y'all's personal interest in things and kind of the drama and the angles you seem to enjoy exploring as a group type of thing. And it's, I really like Lover in the Ice. I think it's a very good, subtle, different Delta Green story. It's technically a bug hunt, but also like not really a bug hunt. And just the horror in it is fantastic. It has a very twisted and dark sense of humor kind of baked into the background of it that, like, from a kind of handler and, like, trying to tell a horror story perspective, I think just it has potential for great highs of comedy, which just make the horror aspects of it so much more devastating. Like, and I guess in that aspect of it, like, there's a couple tweaks here and there. I think I kind of played up the psychosexual fugue state of Skip Mills, because I think it kind of like, when you don't know what's going on with that, it's funny. Like, it is a very weird tone for a Delta Green operation. Like, it's very strange to have like the gross out humor of like, dude was masturbating in his office. And like in book as written, it's just some jizz underneath his desk. I chose to take it to the extreme of it's fucking everywhere because it's funnier. And it got like the laugh out of it for you guys where it's like, oh, haha, this is going to be one of those things. And then the realization of what that means kind of sets the tone for the rest of this where it's like, oh no, something real fucked up's going on actually.
Yeah.
See, weirdly enough, I think if it was just dried sperm underneath his desk or anything else like that, I don't think I would have taken it as seriously as it was like it, like just dried sperm being everywhere.
Yeah.
Because, oh man, that unfortunately is something I've seen before and whatever the heck. And it's like, oh, that's like a weird, unfortunate, mundane occurrence.
People are gross, but that's not outside the kind of, really it's on the extremes, but like it's not outside the norm, if you will. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Like that's just human nature. But if it's like, if everything is just glowing like a goddamn Jackson Pollock painting, yeah, at that point in time, it's like, okay, something is obviously wrong. And I think that's really just what cemented it for me in my head as a like critical situation of like, oh, Skip Mills is fucked.
No, and that's why I made that change, I think. Like, I think it's one of the few changes I made to the operation to kind of like, I think, boost the, okay, something's really wrong with Skip Mills aspect of it.
Mm.
Yeah, because I think it kind of my reading of it, and this is not a criticism, it's more just kind of a, from a handler kind of view of it. Imagine not having that kind of idea in the back of your head. Like, yeah, you still have the violent pornography, the Big Willie's house of smut call and whatnot, but like you don't really kind of get how depraved the situation has become in some ways. I think you kind of need something to kind of really cement that this is like, this is beyond kind of compulsion and boredom and kind of normal human bad behavior. This is something's up. And I guess like, and this is a question for you guys more than that, kind of explain it, like, did kind of that in the back of your brain change how you went into Skip Mills's house?
I think, yeah, just because like hyper violent porn and everything else of the sort can be rationalized in a way, at least for me, in the way that like, okay, like, yeah, to understand people and to understand like human nature, it's, there's a lot of really, really wild things that you might not be accustomed to, or you might not find palatable, but other people are. But to kind of push it beyond to where it becomes like supernatural, otherworldly, just over the top, it puts it in a place where like it's I don't want to say digestible because you just don't want to associate that word, but it's you process the information much, much different. I mean, I guess like also the phone call from like, has it always been Big Willie's?
It does not have a name. It just is a porn store.
Oh, okay. I was about to say, I was like, oh gosh, I cannot believe I didn't even catch that. But
I make these jokes for y'all.
Thank you.
Is it Big Willie or Big Larry's?
I thought it was Big Larry.
You're right. I think it was Big Larry. Yeah.
I was like, man, that was a really obvious joke that I missed. What the heck? I don't think I would have walked into Skip Mills' house. I think he would have been like, all right, cool. This dude's a little blasé about his work environment. But
this is indeed not safe for work.
Oh, yeah. But now he was like, okay, cool. This dude's a threat. This is...
Or at least a topic, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
No, yeah, it's... It's a relatively straightforward operation, interestingly. Like, you only have four or five locations of note that actually matter, basically. It's Skip Mills' house, it's the girls' kind of apartment. There's a extra location you guys did not go to, which is the repair worker. The person that was fixing the pipe is the, I think, landlord, officially, of the house. And you can go to her house, and if you go there, there's an extra Monte there to pop up and say hi. It's kind of a diversion. There's not really much extra to be gleaned from that location that you can't glean from everything else. I guess like it's also possible to have a big part of the setting is that there is a college there. Like you can use the facilities of it hypothetically to do scientific study. Like that's where you can go and find out how the orange fluid from the cedar slash Amante actually works.
Okay. Because when you said DNA testing, I was in my head, I was like, where? How?
I mean, also the morgue.
I thought the morgue was like here's like a body, but I didn't have access to the other materials or whatever.
Not officially, not by Filigree's permission, but again, like you have FEMA, and while FEMA maybe wasn't going to hold up the best, at the same time, you could probably use FEMA to gain access and be like, we need your facilities.
Huh. I really need to start taking more of our cover into consideration, I guess, when it comes to role-playing, or at least like as a tool. Because in my head, the cover has always been like, oh, this is the reason why we're here. Not really like an active means of getting through space.
I mean, sometimes it's useful, sometimes it isn't. We've had a couple instances where I've intentionally set it up as it might being a hindrance in certain circumstances. Like, it could be used as a brute force tool, but then it's also like, yeah, no, it's also then a problem. Like, in like Weirdwood, it's a ticking time bomb where eventually the real FBI is going to show up, but also, as far as they know, you're the FBI agents that are supposed to be there until they're like, wait, who are these people?
So I feel like this is the most involved we've been with our cover.
Yes.
To the point where like I've took time to maintain cover. Cause it felt like it really did feel so fragile and so like you could take it away from us so easily.
Yeah.
This was the first time that this is one of the first times that I was legit worried that we would lose cover and then we were just fucked.
And the book even makes a point of saying, or the operation spells out, like, from the handler side of things, stress, this is not a good cover. Like, it is fragile. Do not put us in a situation where we have to, like, have it checked because it's going to fall apart real quick if they do. But also, like, at the same time, if a bunch of people show up with a National Guard convoy and say they're FEMA, would you honestly be like, I don't know, these people don't look like FEMA people?
I legit have no idea how in the world Star was able to get back to the fucking relief camp and be able to do everything that he was able to do. Dylan, you are one of the most quick-witted and just go-with-the-flow players I've ever played with, and I'm constantly impressed by just how easily you can turn an awful situation up on its head to your advantage.
I appreciate that. I mean, I thought I was done for a lot there.
Oh, I was trying.
I know you were trying. I mean, I was ready to shoot my way out or die. So
I wanted that cedar out there. I wanted the home scene of that cedar killing his wife and family. I wanted it.
Look,
you took it from me.
Here's the thing, Charlie. I was going to kill that man or I was getting out with him.
Oh, I know.
So
I, for one, was looking forward to Star versus the entire National Guard.
That would have been terrible.
I was 100% ready for Snail versus the Green Box. The amount of shit that you were just willy-nilly getting yourself into.
It wasn't even all the stuff in the Green Box.
I respect it. I respect messing with Green Boxes. I'm a coward. I don't do it.
Same. It just with this sort of situation, I was just like, nah, dog. I had not.
We saw why I don't fuck with it. Like, you, what was in there? The flute that played off in the distance or something?
A violin, but yeah.
Yeah. I wanted to fuck around with one of the boxes. We haven't played a game where I fucked around with a box yet, and this was my time to shine. So I ran with it.
You're valid. Yeah, you're valid. I get it.
You lived free in a world where I was just too caught up in my own bullshit to just live my truth. You were out there touching shit, fiddling with doodads.
So, Anna, I guess kind of a little Delta Green insider lore for y'all. GB224 is the infamous green box that contains the much debated decorative box. The green box item that can just straight up kill a PC in one dice roll.
All right, what was it?
You guys didn't mess with it, but there is, I'll read the description. Decorative box. There is a huge nine-sided shape carved from some unidentifiable hardwood. That basically, it's a puzzle box, and that if you solve the puzzle, you just stop existing.
Did I ever actually encounter the puzzle box at all?
Nah, so the way the green box works, you may not remember this, it was basically a roll table I was having you guys go through as we were doing it. Like, there's a certain randomness to it, and a couple times I kind of nudged it. So, like, I think the list of hands is a cool, weird thing to have in a green box. So I made sure you guys got this. My favorite thing from the green box. So, of course, someone was fucking getting the list of hands.
Yeah, I want to say Snail. I was so excited to see Snail develop because you had rolled. He's the guy you rolled that was like just a beast, right?
No, that's actually not my beast character. That was my weakest character.
Okay. Well, I'm very excited to see how the character you rolled Insane on develops.
For those who confused what we're talking about right now, if you're a Patreon subscriber, you get access to the session zero for this. We each made three characters each. And yeah, so as we kind of outlined as this, we have a hitter, we had an investigator, we had a specialist. I think we had, Jad, you were the specialist this time around with the doctor character. Dylan, you were running your hitter, obviously. And Alex, you had your investigator for this.
Yes, I ran an investigator this time around.
I do want to say, I usually don't play hitters, but I had a lot of fun playing a hitter this time. Just being like an abrasive asshole, that was kind of...
It's a fun op to be a hitter in because like you're just kind of along for the ride until the Amante starts showing up. And then it's like, okay, cool. I get what my job is. Fight the monkeys.
I thought I was dead, dude. I thought I was dead so many times.
Again, Dylan, I was trying.
I'm aware. I remember when I got punched for 6 damage.
Man, I thought like I was absolutely royally fucked against like 2 sex crazed college like women. Thankfully Alex had picked up filigree. I mean, like ripped to Snail, just that joyous, weirdly mentally image John Goodman that like John Goodman was rolling with whatever the heck, and so him in bandages and whatever and whatnot just lost to the ages. Absolutely sucks. But filigree, thank God, knew how to use a gun. Because man, Sanguine is not anyone made for a fight.
We'll get you there.
I mean, he's already adapted to violence and helplessness, and he's a doctor, a surgeon, no less. Imagine what the implications of that are.
Whoops. He died on the table. Well, next patient.
Plastic surgeon with no empathy for human life. Yes, it is tragic. Your beloved one died as part of this. They got in the way of my art.
Oh, that angle?
Up to Jed.
That's an angle.
We'll see how Sanguine develops.
Coming for those sand points.
Yeah, it was very fun. I said it already. It's very fun playing a hitter, but playing someone with like high like physical stats is like really fun too. Like catching the Amante out of the air when it jumped the Sanguine initially was fun. Just being able to do a lot of like ridiculous stuff is neat.
No, I think kind of there's a Delta Green is not a game about guns or bug hunts or stuff like that, but like there's room for cool action moments, I guess, and with it the kind of within the kind of flexibility of the rules for it. And yeah, I look forward to every single star fight because it's like, okay, how are we doing this? The fact we got the star versus the full grown Amante in the locker room showdown as kind of star's big finale in some ways. I'm like, hell yes.
I was very satisfied with that fight because it was a back and forth. And at the end of it, I was like, man, how am I going to outsmart this thing? I was like, well, Star's not very smart, so he's just going to shoot it.
What's Star's instat out of curiosity? It's like 9, right?
I think it's 8.
So the Amante's intelligence is also 8.
Yes, it was a battle of titanic intellect.
It's also got a strength of 19 and a dex of 20, so.
Well, I guess it's human over Amante.
I always love a good man versus monster story when it's like only a man can kill a monster type of thing. Like, yeah, I love when you have that kind of cool, like, okay, this thing obviously outclasses me in every possible way. Well, time to go kill it.
It was just like, you know, we were circling and I'm like, ah, I'm going to outsmart it. And then it like looked at me like, nah. And I was like, fuck.
I really did enjoy the like, well, this chainsaw gambit didn't work. Back to firearms.
An oldie buddy goodie.
Let's hit it with the old reliable.
I think it was fun to see that like its reaction to that was like, wait, what? What just happened?
Doesn't know what a gun is. Yeah. I'm bleeding my own blood. What the hell?
That's illegal.
It's blind. Like, you can't even see you pull a gun on it, hypothetically. Like, imagine how terrifying that would be on its end. Loud sound happens and suddenly lots of pain.
So I'm curious now that you've said it, Charlie, circling back, how many National Guardsmen were at the high school?
It does not give you an answer. I had worked out a system in my brain where basically it was going to be kind of chase rules where every time you failed, you'd have to fight 1d4 minus one of them.
Oh.
That would have been a very fun way for Star to die, trying to guerrilla tactics his way through a school.
Yeah, it would have been cool. Nah, I also enjoy the fact you kind of managed to bullshit your way out of it. Yeah, there was some very smart calls on your part where it's like going through the kitchen. I'm like, yeah, no, that's good call. I got nothing on that one.
I really felt like you gave us each a moment to shine on our own in terms of importance of character. It didn't feel like, I mean, yeah, we had kind of coverage in specialist investigator operator, but it didn't feel like any one individual was more important than the other.
Yeah, I think the only character I nudged you towards was you probably want a hitter for this and a Jad because you have a doctor character, maybe bring the doctor character because in hindsight, that surgery is real useful.
Oh, yeah, I wanted to bring in my anti-poaching agent or whatever the heck, I think, initially, but definitely having a doctor on Lover in the Ice was quintessential.
At the same time, imagine how cool anti-poaching agent is dealing with strange ape creature.
There's gonna be like some complicated emotions probably, because it's like, ooh, this is a brand new life form, but yeah, it's killing people.
I mean, worse than that, like it's not just killing people, it's repurposing people basically.
Yeah, it was turning them into vectors.
Yeah. So speaking of low intelligence scores, when did we run into the pipe fixer?
She is the body in the basement. The hints for that is she has a toolbox with her that's kind of down there. The pipes are obviously not damaged, the whole fake call. If you had checked her phone, there is a message from, I think you actually guys actually did. Like, I think I haven't mentioned this. Like, there is a, no, she leaves a message on one of the phones you found that's like, hey, I'm coming over to fix the pipes and stuff.
Oh, yeah, there was just a body in the basement.
It had an Amante in it. It burst out. You killed it. It was the first Amante you fought.
For whatever reason, it didn't like click to me the fact that that was just like a person. Well, that's such a horrible thing to say. I
adapted to violence and helplessness, you say?
Well, a creature burst out of it and started attacking us. I didn't think like, okay, cool, this person needs to...
Yeah.
This person, we need to check this person. No, that person or that corpse just needs to burn now.
Yeah, and the description the book gives is pretty much like they're pretty barely human by the time the whole kind of incubation period is done.
Gotcha.
It, like, not to get too graphic because this is deep diving on this, but like it's basically like a sleeping bag made of human.
Oh.
No, that kind of goes back to the, like, there are lots of things you can track down that sometimes they reward you, sometimes they don't, but like, it's still very possible to arrive at the correct ending without the full kind of context of it. And I guess to kind of give some kind of, again, a time I had to, like, literally bite my own fingers to stop myself from saying something or giving something away. Sanguine's home scene now means there is an official write-up in the Delta Green Archives. That is wrong.
Oh, fuck. No, it's still research. It's not.
It's 75% correct, I'll give it. But, like, the conclusions drawn from it are probably going to get an agent killed at some point.
Oh, boy.
It's not Delta Green if you aren't your own team's worst enemy.
Oh god, team killing from a distance at that point.
I think it's going to be such a fun scene if Sanguine just kind of stays within orbit or whatever the hell have you, for him to just be delivered that news and just have some sort of weird aspect of it. Because like, all right, cool. He's let one team member die and he's refused care on a victim. He refused real hard to care for a victim. So, man, that's something to digest later.
Sorry, I thought you'd put two and two together on that one already.
No, not really, because I was, because here science is messy, man. It's yeah. It's an observation report. It's not saying that like this is true. It's just saying that like, oops.
Oh, I agree. It was a tidbit. I enjoyed the kind of implications of that. Again, in the moment, you had no idea the implications of it. Where it's like, yeah, you're doing a good thing, and I'm sitting there being like, oh, that means there's misinformation out there about how these things work.
I'm here for it.
Yeah, no, it's something I found interesting. So I guess, like, let's talk about the pink, slightly white hair colored elephant in the room that is Lover in the Ice. This is obviously a bit of a, let's call it, hard operation to run for Delta Green, given the both overt and subtle and pervasive sexual content that ranges from implication to straight up explicit. I do not recommend this operation for every group out there. I think this kind of falls in the cult category for me, where if you have a group that you kind of understand very well, it is possible to run this operation for that group. But go in understanding that from a kind of handler standpoint, there's a lot of work you have to do to kind of set the right tone. It is very, and you guys helped out actually a lot on this by just kind of taking it all seriously. It is very possible to have this entire operation drift into a unfortunate direction, just kind of given what is implied is happening pretty frequently. Like, it's like, let's get blunt for a second. Like, the whole Amante process is coded sexual assault.
Yeah.
And yeah, again, like it's an exceptionally well-written module. It has a reputation though for everything it has a reputation for. It is infamous within Delta Green, and I would definitely not recommend this as a first module for anyone running Delta Green, or even like a third module necessarily, because there's a certain tone you have to maintain. I redid the content warnings for this one specifically because I'm like, yeah, let's emphasize this one's cult, dark, and potentially going to be very, very dark at times. I guess like as you were playing through it, I guess like how much of that was it kind of like how much of that came through, I guess, while we were playing through it.
I think it was very apparent, judging from the like kind of, I guess, the way that we would run into these bodies. It was very much apparent that it was like a very much a predator type situation, luring into an assault, like a sexual assault type thing. So like, yeah, I mean, it was very much coded in that way. So it's understandable, which I think with this group in particular, I think it works only because we understand that like, yeah, this material is pretty heavy when we play it. Like, we have moments where we like joke around, but like, we know, you know, I guess we understand the, what's the word I'm looking for? We understand the tone sometimes when some of this stuff is going on, and we kind of, you know, like there's a difference when we approach the scenes, I think, when we were like find the victims and the monsters in one way, and then we had a certain tone and understanding that way, as opposed to where we go to the trailer and we find out there's, you know, semen everywhere, and we're like, tee hee hee, but also, oh, and like, so there's a difference. Like, in that sense, it was like, okay, yeah, this is, you know, nightmare fuel, but also, you know, it's
kind of funny,
goofy. Yeah, it's funny.
Yeah.
But, you know, then we go into a spot where there are actual, like, you know, I guess NPCs involved in that sense. And we very much approach it differently, because I even remember playing through these sessions, our tone approaching it was very different when we were actually in the scenes with the monsters being there. Am I overanalyzing that, or I felt like it was
I think it's a kind of, to your point, I definitely front loaded kind of the earlier part of the operation with the gross out humor, kind of comedic aspects that are prevalent as part of that. And like, as we go through, it's like, no, this is not funny anymore. Like, this is not meant to be jokes. These are meant to be serious things. Like, it's, yeah, I guess my GM tip for this is it is important to have comedic moments in Delta Green operations. Separate them, and like, yeah, there's some obvious stuff you can do because gross out humor exists. It's a thing. I think all of us, unfortunately, grew up during a time period where it was a very prevalent thing. There are some comedic aspects of some of the earlier on clues. They are early on in the operation, specifically because once you get past a certain point, you have to kind of just let it roll, where it's like, no, this shit is dark. We're not going to make fun of it. Like, it's, there are humorous aspects to things you can find, but like, it has to be treated with the, like, this is dark aspects of it. Like, this is not a laughing matter, I guess, is the way of thinking of it. We probably had the most aftercare for this one of all the stuff we've played so far, too.
I think so.
Yeah.
I would say, yeah, close to it, if not very close second with, like, Cult. I remember Cult, we spent a lot of time, like, close, kind of just, like, checking in to make sure everybody's cool, given the context of what was going on with all that. Yeah.
Cult was nutty, but at the same time, it wasn't as, like, with this specific content in this specific group. I trusted Charlie as a handler to be able to handle this with care and dignity, and I trusted my fellow players to not view like violation of body autonomy as a means of a, like, I knew what your guys's intentions are when it comes to your own humor, as well as like how you treat the game and like just the dark content we experience like as Delta Green players well enough that like I don't think I've ever felt uncomfortable working with what we had in front of us. Like, yes, we can, I knew that we could enjoy some dumb like, ah, man, there's jizz everywhere jokes, but at the same time, like, hey, we're also now dealing with what could be understood as a not stand-in for like sexual assault cases or anything else like that, but something that just closely mirrors it, or yeah, at least is. I know you guys aren't assholes, like, and I know that you guys are trustworthy players. So, like, at no point in time was I like, oh man, let's hope that this session rolls without a hitch.
No, and I commend you guys for kind of, it's easy to kind of start making jokes as things get uncomfortable. And I this only works if kind of people treat it with the right tone the entire way through. And then we get a breather where Alice gets stuck jumping across the table, where it's like, okay, we can laugh at this moment. Yes, this is a comedic moment separated from all the shit that just happened.
Yeah. I think that's one of the things that's like really kind of just shines with the way we approach stuff. Like, this is gonna be a, I don't even want to say it's a humble brag, I want to say it's just a flat out brag, but I think this group knows how to compartmentalize very well when it comes to like serious subjects that we like know that we shouldn't be joking about, where or and when to like have those like comedic relief moments. And I think it shows up really well, because like we have dice rolls that are like really crazy and they can be really intense, and like sometimes we'll joke around, but sometimes it's really in like the moment of something that's going on that's like really crucial or intense. And it's never jokey, even at that point. Like, even though we want to be, oh my God, these roles are awful, this and that, but it's just like, oh, like we experience the emotion behind it. But I think it's just because we were really good at like compartmentalizing the like when we know to be serious, when we know to kind of have a good laugh and whatnot. And honestly, I think it shines really well and when it shows up in some of the work. In this one, and especially I think in, I always mention this one too, because I think like Cult was probably one of my favorite recordings personally, but it was like we had intense moments there, and it like it shows like we know how to like compartmentalize and when to like know to be serious, when to be kind of jokey.
No, and I think actually kind of to pull a less, I guess, charged moment, a kind of a less serious moment throughout the entire run of Lover in the Ice, like the car crash, I think, is a fantastic moment to dissect, because it starts off funny. Like, it starts off with Dylan throwing himself out of the car and the other, and you two staying in the car and starting to spin and situation getting worse. And it's funny at first. Yeah, it's a slow motion car wreck that we're playing through. And then by the end, no one's cracking jokes. Like, it's dark. It's like you can kind of watch as that whole sequence plays out, the transition from like, oh haha, isn't this funny, to
yeah, like to be aware that situationally it is kind of funny, like from start to finish, because conceptually we're dealing with other world, like unrecognizable fathoms, yet the thing that got us was poor infrastructure, or not poor infrastructure, but just like something so everyday that this is like, oh man, you better watch out for the roads or whatever the heck. But it also was just such a great little reminder of just the fragility of just how agents are, because like we're just people.
Yeah, not to make Lover in the Ice all about cult in some ways, but I think there is an interesting conversation to be had about kind of like the impact that game had. I think it's from an editing perspective, it fundamentally changed how you guys play the game, how you guys play tabletop RPGs, as best I can tell. Like it is, the interactions are very different. Like I'm not saying they were bad or anything prior, but there's definitely like, I spend so much time kind of re-listening to our audio over and over as I'm going through it, processing parts of it. It's different. Yeah. There's an interesting kind of evolution that has come to an end at Lover in the Ice that I think kind of, I'm not sure we could have run Lover in the Ice as effectively if we had kind of started that evolution in some ways. And it's not just cult. It's been kind of a lot of playing Delta Green, kind of just also playing together as a group. Again, like this is a long way of saying Lover in the Ice is a hell of a Delta Green operation. I think it's, there are people that will really enjoy their time with it. It is not one you can just throw at a group. And I think anyone running this thing as just a straight up one shot is doing it a disservice. Also, I think it's, I don't want to say like dangerous or something, but like this whole operation rushed, I think, I'm sure you can play it in a way that kind of maintains respect for the subject matter, but I think it kind of does a slight disservice at the same time to it too.
Yeah, I'm inclined to agree with that.
On to more exciting topics, or on to kind of more upbeat topics, I guess, now that we've gotten through that part. Do people have favorite moments, I guess, from Lover in the Ice?
The car scene was just stupid funny.
The car scene was very good. I enjoyed describing Star dress up like an action hero and drive off in like a wide-brimmed hat to go fight a monster in a gym.
It was in that moment I vowed my hardest to try and kill Star.
Can I just say, like, the idea of like you literally going in with a fucking chainsaw, just the whole idea, that just sounds hard as fuck. Like, you went hard in that moment, and I thought that was great. Like, you deserve credit for that, because that was just the major kudos for just being that super fucking hard as a hitter for that.
There was a sequence of that I just gave Dylan points for Dylan's charisma of like striding confidently while holding a chainsaw and acting like you were absolutely in the right, where it's like, yeah, fuck it. Like, no one's gonna ask about the chainsaw because he's obviously supposed to be here with a chainsaw.
I mean, I thought about it, and Star was like, I mean, I'm here on a mission, so I gotta do a thing. And he wasn't gonna let anyone stop him, he wasn't going to willingly let anyone stop him.
Part of me, because we spent so much time talking about kind of how Star's a bit of an idiot, part of me was like, is Dylan playing up the aspect that maybe Star's not smart enough to know that this is suspicious as hell?
Once I realized Star was Florida man, I was like, okay.
That's a very good way to describe him, because he's literally from Florida. So
I made a joke about Florida man, and he's like, oh, my character is from Florida. I was like, okay, cool, it's Florida man. I'm so down and so happy that we have Agent Florida man.
But like dangerously competent Florida man.
Yeah.
Yeah, Florida man that can claim that he works for NASA, which is, it's technically true. That's technically true.
I had so much fun researching the security agent you type you were playing. I'm like, what the hell is this? I'm like, oh, this is like a legit thing. What are the appropriate insults for this?
I mean, it was very funny, like, because I remember I decided I was just going to play a lot of random people, and like all the agencies I've picked are just like random that I've never seen in Delta Green before. I think I have an NSA character.
Yeah, that'll be in the next thing we would Delta Green. I mean, like, you've never seen a CDC character before?
I didn't make another CDC character.
That's fair, yeah. I guess, like, Florence was CDC.
Yeah, Florence was CDC.
Oh, you're talking for this batch, yeah. It's
this batch. I have played CDC characters before, which are my favorite. I like the idea that people have to, like, you can just, you know, sling a lot of random lingo at people. And because you're from the CDC, they're like, okay.
Yeah.
I have a weird fascination when it comes to my Delta Green agents, because I kind of like watching my toys break. The fact that I was able to just rack up that many.
Sanguine is breaking in the best ways possible. And knowing what I know about his bonds, I cannot wait to see how Sanguine spirals out.
Hearing you say that, Jad tells me you've reached peak tabletop player. I find immense joy in watching my characters break down into nothing.
Because, like, I don't know, there was something about Faustus where I had goals and I had plans. And, like, I was like, oh, man, I think it would be really funny if you had the priest start looking more into hypergeometry and, like, magic, which would cause him to be, like, an enemy of the program and everything else like that. And I got Firestarter, who's like, all right, neat. This is someone who is, air quotes, broken, but still kind of works within whatever the heck. The real turning point definitely was Cult, in where I just had a really shitty character that I just had to figure out what to do with. And like having her kind of break down, like watching her be broken down by your character, I was like, oh, this is so good.
I do want to say, like, the way you played your character in Cult was like so unsettling and so amazing. Overall, I think, like, one of the best times I've seen someone play like an absolutely evil character in like a despicable way that was still entertaining.
I assume Sanguine was kind of actually a foil to that some, because like a lot of it's kind of like opposite character in some ways, where it's like, yeah, it's another doctor character, but like, it's, I don't want to be doing this. And I appreciate the fact that like the entire way through, he was trying to help people, not always successful in such an endeavor, and in some cases really unsuccessful, but like, you kept trying, I guess, kind of like across the violence and the helplessness adaptations, you got to kind of see that play out in interesting ways. And I really am curious to see what happens to Sanguine next.
Yeah, so like watching my toys break and just letting that one decision, like I really was mulling over the decision to kill, what was it? Chad.
Chad.
Yeah, what's up?
No, Chad.
Chad. Oh, I can't believe I got
leave that in, please.
Alex, was it intentional you never pronounced Chad's name the same way twice?
No, I don't think I did.
You kept messing again, like this fantastic, like ongoing thing through Lover in the Ice was one of you would say something slightly wrong, and then it would become this fantastic game of telephone where, like, I think you called Chad Bergman like the Bergster or something like that, and then that became what Sanguine thought Chad's name was, and then you kept getting Chad's last name wrong in new ways.
Wasn't intended, but I'm glad it kind of played out like that.
That makes it even better. Like, that's like, that is some real, like, I don't know who the fuck this person is. Like, I'm sitting there like an editing, I'm like, is this fucker intentionally doing this? Like, because it was always like 80% correct, and the remaining 20% was like the last like four word letters would be totally wrong. And I'm like, I gotta remember to ask him about this, because like, if this was intentional, this is amazing.
Yeah, I wish I was that clever.
It was great. Tanisha's got to try and fix it, and then you did it like, and it was a different second time. And I'm like, oh no, this is a bit now. Cool.
Okay, with that role, I really just didn't know if I wanted to, if I should be taking Sanguine down that path. Because it's like, well, ultimately he's a doctor. He took a Hippocratic oath. Like, how is he gonna reconcile that? But leaving that to the dice, that was just like, all right, here's how this game's gonna play out for me. My favorite moment was failing that role, because now I have to figure out what to do with this fucked up little doctor.
Yeah, Lover in the Ice overall was a lot of fun for just kind of rolling with the dice rolls, like the three crits in a row where it's like, oh yeah, we're fucking nailing this. Paired against like the car ride from hell.
Yeah. I'm still really beat up over the fact that I couldn't save Snail. Like, not gonna lie. Like, that, I was like, God damn it. This is my character class. This is what this character is built for.
Yeah. I kind of felt bad, honestly, as I kept throwing you curveballs where it's like, okay, cool, you survived this car crash, but you basically have no health. Here's this fight where you lose even more health and you pass out, and like now there's a thing in you and you have to adapt to that. Like, you could not have a consistent character that's kept throwing things at you. Oh, do you guys want to know the secret mechanic I came up with for all the drugs you kept giving us, Snail?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
So I didn't tell you this because it made more sense for you not to know about it. I was taking a point of damage off every time he took damage from basically how many doses he was rolling on. But keeping track of all the damage that was taken off, because if I basically had like a timer going on, I'm like, okay, this is going to wear off eventually. And then I'm going to apply all this damage again next time he gets hit, basically. We never got to that point, but like, I think there was like almost 4 points of damage stored.
That I had stored?
That I had kind of, took off damage you took, right? Maybe it's 2 or 3 points. Like, it was enough where like, it was possible you were basically going to go into shock and die if something happened. I'm like, okay, like, he's got like, in my head, I'm like, okay, we got like one or two more scenes before the painkillers wear off. And if he gets hit again after that point, he is done, but didn't make it that far.
Yeah, I knew I was going to make it that far because I was lingering at one HP for so fucking long that I was like, a breeze is going to knock me down. It's just a matter of time. I'm going to get a nice wind chill blow. And I'm just going to fall over in the snow right then and there.
It's one of the weird situations, too, where like health points in tabletop RPGs are always so weird where it's like, okay, my fighter is capable of functioning with one HP just as well as he can with all of his HP mechanically. Like, what does that look like? But in our case, it's like, no, this man survived car crash and then getting tackled downstairs. Those aren't life-threatening injuries inherently, but like, you can visualize just like being like 80% a bruise and internal bleeding at that point.
Oh, he had an open wound in his neck.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, that's why the whole time I was like...
That's why I kept shoving pills down your throat. I was like, I'm going to try to keep you alive as long as I can. I don't think this is a good idea, but we'll see.
That's, I think, where the whole kind of misconception about how the Amante thing started. Because I think you interpreted as the thing trying to stab him in the neck, as it trying to like go down his neck. And that's what that was going. It was trying to inject him with enough orange stuff it could turn him into an incubi.
Oh, okay.
It was trying to get that kill. And I had a whole kind of thing prepared for, like, if you left Snail's dead body full of the orange stuff around long enough, it was going to hatch. Like, I was very deliberately keeping track of the number of times you all said, oh, we should burn this house down, and then didn't.
We were getting distracted. It was difficult. There was so many things to do.
A very human reaction given all the stimuli going on. Yes.
So earlier you mentioned that like Lover in the Ice is, I mean, like, it is, it's not such a common thing to run, or it is a little bit more of a difficult thing to run. What led you to have us run it then? Like, what led you, what was ultimately like the basis of like, okay, cool, I think we could not just run this, but record this? Was it just kind of like the time that we've kind of spent together just to get to know each other and our play styles and stuff? Or
a little bit of that. I think like mechanically the operation is pretty straightforward. Like, from a things to keep track of perspective, there's not that much going on, and it's a combination, like, not to, again, not to make this all about Cult, we're talking about Lover in the Ice, but I think kind of our success with navigating Cult gave me hope we could run this. And like, I'll say it again, this is one of, unironically, my favorite Deltarune operations. Like, the writing for it is, from a like appreciation of a module, not a ton of pages, it's actually a fairly short collection type of thing. It's not a long one, there's not lots of parts to it, but what's there is really well written and really intriguing. And it's kind of finding that balance between, like, my favorite Deltarune operations are not necessarily the community's favorite kind of Deltarune operations, and kind of taking a big step back at looking at kind of all the modules that are run by other podcasts and other people and kind of what's popular. I tend to gravitate towards the ones that I find interesting first, or kind of I like a lot. Like, we played Jack Frost. that's not one that's talked a lot about within Delta Green. I think it should be, because I find it a fascinating one, but mechanically it is hard. And I think kind of from a different side of the coin, mechanically, Lover in the Ice, not so hard. Tone-wise, horror-wise, that kind of stuff, it's very challenging. And again, I keep kind of going back to Colt on this one. I think kind of we navigated that one successfully. I think we did a really good job of that. That was kind of like my little bit of a test of, okay, can we run something this dark? Like, it's weird saying I think Lover in the Ice is darker than Oakwood Heights is, but I generally think it is. I think it's like you have a larger range of things that can go very wrong in Lover in the Ice from a kind of tone and content perspective than Oakwood Heights. It's much harder to kind of course correct because it's just so baked into what it is. And I think like part of the credit is kind of how well it can run. It's just the quality of writing in it. Like, there's no questions from a handler perspective of kind of how to go about handling some of these things. And I'm talking as though kind of like touching this book will make your hands rot off. It's not like it is not kind of unapproachable in some ways. I always think of Delta Green as kind of a R-rated game in general. So as a result, kind of you have a spectrum of that where you have the small R or the big R. And I think of Lover in the Ice as kind of one of the biggest R's in Delta, and kind of the Delta Green kind of canon of every part of Delta. There's no Delta Green operation without some kind of questionable content or kind of some uncomfortable or potentially risky content. But like from the jump, Lover in the Ice is just going full bore in that topic. Like if it was in the movies, it would be, do we make this NC-17 or not? Like it's making the most of its R rating, if that makes any sense. It just kind of felt like we were ready for it, if that makes any sense. Like both from what we've successfully run in the past, from what we've kind of managed to grow as a podcast, from kind of a production standpoint, from just kind of like all the parts came together and it just felt like it was finally time to run this. Like we try and work at least kind of one canonical Delta Green operation in every once in a while. And this one's not out there as much for all the reasons we've talked about. And I completely get why. I'm not saying that's a bad thing necessarily. I was happy to kind of be able to finally contribute to kind of that repertoire of, hey, here's some Delta Green stuff you can listen to that's not of the most commonly run things, if that makes any sense. And there was a very deliberate kind of, okay, can we do Lover in the Ice yet? And I was honestly kind of prepared to pull this thing the entire way through kind of thing too. Like we got deep enough into it recording wise from like, okay, we're good. We have a good tone. Like we're playing through this right. But like I did not announce this, that we were doing it till we were a little bit into it. I'm like, okay, yeah, like we can make this work. If that makes any sense. I guess that answered the question though, Jed.
Yeah. It's because form and content, it's a little surprising. I know that like Delta Green gets dark. When you said like Lover in the Ice, ha 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 ha, it's around Valentine's Day. Whatnot, I thought it was like a little cheeky. We get to the kind of nitty gritty of it outside of like the slapstick gags and shit. Like it was, I definitely felt like the mode change. I could feel the switch kind of when we got into like really focused, we're agents versus, oh man, we're like a group just kind of sitting around cracking jokes.
Yeah.
Here and there. So especially as a handler kind of taking us through modules and kind of taking us through your story, it's always interesting to see how you are guiding us as players to challenge us or really just kind of give us these new sandboxes to play around. It's like a judgment call on your end, I guess. And I always kind of wonder what's your lesson plan? What's your rubric? You know, sometimes.
Yeah, I go by gut to a certain extent. Like this has been one I've wanted to do for a while. And it's been it's weird calling Lover in the Ice one of my favorite Delta Green modules. But at the same time, like it's from a deep respect for the writing and kind of like how well it is crafted. Like it's horrifying content. I'm not going to kind of shy away from that. But like from a quality of work standpoint, it's very good without kind of, yeah, it's Caleb is a hell of a writer on this one. Yeah, it's been in the back of my mind of kind of like, and I think I was prepared that we would never record this hypothetically too. Like it's one of those ones where it's like, yeah, maybe we just never do Lover in the Ice. And after Colt, it was like, okay, maybe we can do Lover in the Ice. Like let's fucking swing for the fences for a little bit.
Yeah, no, I agree. I'm actually glad you decided to take the risk and kind of dive into this one, because it was a good module and everything to do. So,
man, I guess kind of like we've talked about this several times. We've kind of done these deep dives of this kind of like how kind of important the group dynamic is for some of the stuff we play. And this is one of those ones where kind of like it's the, I just kind of knew the group was ready for that, if that makes any sense. And like, I think I even like did the whole thing beforehand of like, hey, here's kind of what Lover in the Ice is about. I'm going to be vague about it, but like, are we cool with this? Maybe not cool, but like, are we all comfortable kind of embarking on this endeavor?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that is definitely Lover in the Ice. Any other questions, I guess, or comments you want to throw at Lover in the Ice?
No, I don't really have anything else. Said other than it was fun to play out something different again. And thank you, as always, for doing a good job handling the subject material and all that. And of course, thank you to my cohorts. As always, you know, we tackled it and we did it really well. And I'm glad, you know, if I'm going to be jumping into any of these kind of things, that it's you guys that I'm doing it with. So.
No, and I guess kind of building off that for a quick second, if after this you are curious about playing Lover in the Ice, like, don't let all of the kind of warnings we throw at this dissuade you from that. If you think your group is ready or you think they'd find it interesting, go for it. My pro tip is fight the instinct to get overly explicit. The book even says, like, kind of keep it vague. I think that's the most important piece of advice you can give for this thing. Like, there's you feel it when you're running this, like, to go kind of as horrible as you can. And this is one you should not.
Hmm. Oh, before I forget, Alex, I just wanted to make kudos and make mention. You give your characters such life and such immediate, like, you can really get us to be invested in your characters so quickly. Like, Snail was there for like half of the mission and you really felt the loss.
Yes.
You really felt the loss of just like this kind of jolly, jolly postman individual. And like immediately kind of just developing filigree in a single scene and making it so solid. Like, I feel like I flounder with some of my characters here and there because I just need to feel out what they would do until like something kind of concrete latches on into my head. But like, you really just in like one go just hit the ground with these guys. So I just want to give you kudos on that.
Thank you. I will be perfectly honest. A lot of the times when like we're approaching new characters, like there are some times where like I honestly don't know where I'm gonna go with a character. And like I have this moment of like in my head as we start kind of playing things out, I rewrite certain things, and then something happens in our initial interactions that just like completely makes a decision for that character. And then it just like, I don't know what it is, but it's one of those like things that Charlie mentioned. You just kind of have to feel it out for my, like, that's, I wish I could say I do this elaborate planning and like deep dive and like, I'm like sitting here planning things an hour ahead, but honestly, like, there's just something about the interaction that you guys bring that makes it really easy to like manifest something at that point. And I just kind of run with it. And like the group just plays it so well. So like there's no way I'd be able to pull that off if I didn't have such a good like group to like do that with. So like the only reason my characters have any kind of flourishing potential is because you guys are like awesome at like helping set the scenes and things like that. And Charlie setting things up. So like, yeah, any kudos is also right back at you guys again. So like, yeah, just wanted to share that because I was just like, I really do enjoy doing these characters with you guys. And I just like kind of like when something just clicks for us and then like the group has this really good dynamic at that point and it goes really well.
I just wanted to say, I think like some of probably my favorite scenes to play out in the games we've played, Alex, is where there's high intensity situations between your characters and mine. Like, I still remember when we were playing Colt, and I had to try to talk you down from shooting my character in the back. That was like one of the most intense situations and probably one of my most, like one of my top moments in the games we've played.
Yeah, I really enjoyed that moment too, because I remember like when we were sitting here and we were role playing that, I legit was like sitting up from my chair and like doing these like back and forth body movements like with myself as I was doing this discussion, like, and like all this. And it's just like I get, you haven't really, well, we've never actually met in person, so like Charlie knows I'm very animated as a person when I speak, but like there's a lot of hand movements and things like that. So when I'm like in those kind of like scenes, I'm literally doing that here in my chair, like doing these like movements with my hands and like interacting, or if like if my character's panicking, or that moment, you know, like again back in cult when we're like, I'm like literally looking back and forth between you and, you know, this the body on the ground, like literally I'm turning my heads back and forth, like playing this all out. And it's just, that's just how I am as like a mannerism. And so I'm glad it comes off well in recording. I know, you know, obviously not in video because we all, this is an audio recording, but yeah, like I'm very animated when I do that. And so I'm glad it comes through.
Yeah, it does. It does. It was great.
I live in fear of the day you punch a mic mid-sentence. I know it's coming.
I probably will one day.
I can hear the motion in the talking and I'm like, don't punch the mic. Don't punch the mic. Don't punch the mic.
Do it. You know you want to.
Who knows? I might find a character that's just completely... just doesn't care and like might just hit halfway through an interaction to start punching, and that'll be the moment. But
I mean, Snail is like, Snail's archetype in the background is kind of guy that seems to actually kind of like being in Delta Green. It's something I always have a soft spot for. Like I was genuinely sad when I'm like, oh no, I have to do this to Snail. Still got to do this.
Yeah, it was. I have to say the only thing missing from that whole sequence was like, oh man, this is my last mission. I'm going to get to retire with my family. And then like a backstory montage before I inevitably die. That's the only thing that was missing at that point.
Yeah.
Like, I think it's even more tragic. The fact that you just like, oh, you know that this dude's just, this dude has like a good life outside of fucking shitty ass Sanguine and shitty ass Star. Like, this is the good one.
Yeah. You're... Just a reminder, one of the most impactful things of that entire Lover in the Ice, Lover in the Ice, was Snail's death, because Snail's death caused Sanguine's adaptation to helplessness and Star's adaptation to helplessness. It was the same thing that did it.
Can I admit something? So when my character was about to die, I knew, okay, so first of all, I knew my character was dead when I had one HP. I knew this character was not going to survive the operation. And so when the surgery is going to happen, I was like, I was kind of really hoping the dice would play out where the roles failed. So it would be a really cool story, like for the podcast and everything, but just for us to play out. So like, I know you really wanted to save my character, but at the same time, I was like, it would be really cool if like it just went tragic, and it, you know, and I thought for legit for a moment it was like working out, and then you're like, oh, by the way, now he's drowning with liquid in his lungs, and it's like, oh boy. So it's like, oh yeah, well that's the way to go.
I mean, you were right, because that whole interaction got everyone adapted to helplessness and made the filigree scene right after that where Sanguine's like, shoot through me. And all of that actually worked out to the helplessness help de-escalate the situation, because Filigree was like, what the hell? These people are insane.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. No, it was that was perfect, too, by the way. The whole, oh, I'm just going to go limp, and like it pairing up with the helplessness, by the way, Jad, fucking amazing, because you were just like, yeah, you know what? Just shoot through me. And then when I try to carry you off, you just like, nah, I'm going to go limp. And you literally just went limp. And it was like, OK, like. This is literally like next level. Like, okay. So at that point, my guy just knew like, yeah, there's no point of me really. I can't intimidate these guys. There's no way. It's not going to happen.
It's just beautiful, Sanguine, sad boy energy through that entire scene. I'm like, I'm sitting there being like, is Jad looking up the correct thing to do in this? No, he's just, his character has sudden onset depression in this exact moment. Got it.
That's when I realized like, oh man. Helplessness, whatever the fuck. Before he was like, okay, these are pretty strong. You're gonna want to take two, but no more than two, no more than that. To after Sanguine, after
after Snail died, it was like, anyone want breath mints? I jingle when I walk. Like, come on, let's party.
Who wants drugs? Yeah. I'll bribe these college students. Fuck it.
That was the deciding factor in what changed Sanguine's professionalism.
Can we just talk about the amazing ride of Filigree having to watch apparently a doctor just go and just be like, yeah, fuck it, drugs. I'll bribe my way through with this shit.
No, the Filigree moment for me was like watching like freaking Sanguine walk over and be like, oh, gotta get done. And then just fucking execute someone in like that college dorm room. And I'm just sitting there like, what the fuck? Like,
preceded by a critical success sand check that you got more sane in the moment.
Yeah, like somehow that was the thing that made the most sense at that point. Yeah, like,
wait. I mean, you're like looking at it, right? We're insane. And in that moment, you realize that we're basically the Men in Black.
Yeah.
We are black helicopter people, and you're the only regular person here.
I think I even said basically that in the episode, where just I'm like, you know what? No, this actually makes complete sense. I'm like, how the fuck do I spin? Oh, no, I know exactly how you spin this. Oh, this actually makes sense. All the conspiracies are true. Crazy Larry's not crazy. He's been spouting nothing but truth this entire time. It all makes sense. Fuck it.
Oh, yeah. No, it was again, the dice know when to play and they play correctly every time. I don't ever judge the dice on like, that roll actually could have played out better. No, it's perfect in every way, every single time. Also, I'm very sorry for the mental, the psychic damage from being like, you're holding me, and I'm like, at least it wasn't a green box, and then I fucking pass out.
Yeah.
It wasn't the green box that got him in the end.
Right?
It was his coworker. It was
love. Like an abstract way of thinking it, yeah, it technically was, but...
I mean, you're right, actually, but it wasn't his fault.
That's true.
Yeah. But, again, just... wonderful, wonderful moments throughout that whole campaign. Like, just solid all the way through. Couldn't see it played out any other way with any other group of people. So, I'm happy I'm here.
I like the implication of that sentence is, like, I always knew Snail was going to die in a bathroom choking on a slug monster's blood coming out of his throat.
I didn't think he was going to die until he got down to, like, literally 1 HP. And, like, I'm literally just, I think we spent 2 play sessions with you lingering at 1 HP. Literally 2 play sessions. And it was just like, I'm waiting for the breeze to knock me over. Like,
we left you in the car to keep you safe.
Yeah.
So, and the funniest part of that is once the cedar was in you, I was going to play at the Amante, knew that, so they were going to stop attacking you.
Oh, God damn it.
Oh.
That's so funny. Interesting. That's
and
so funny.
That happened once because he was the obvious target at one point, and it went for someone else because, oh, hey, you're in the family.
Oh, was that when we were upstairs and we were clearing room by room? And like I was in front and it went directly past me to Dylan's character, right?
Yep.
Yeah. I didn't even catch that.
I was wondering why in the world it like skipped him, but that makes total sense. I was just like, all right, maybe the fucking thing knew that Snail was running on like opioids and barbiturates. Like there's nothing there left.
Nah, Kin recognizes Kin.
Yeah. Speaking of like Kin and all that stuff, can I also just appreciate for a moment that like when I have certain things happening to my character, you allow me certain freedoms with it? Like the scene with the laptop where like, I know my character is like phased by it and there's something going on, but you let me like play it out instead of it just being like, okay, whatever, the role's done, you know, the laptop's closed, but you let my character actually like, you gave my character the free, or I guess you gave me the freedom to let my character kind of linger and play out that realization. That was a lot of fun to like play out. I know he was doomed, but it was like, I always appreciate the freedom you give us with like a little bit of the like, some of the roles or like I'll mention things that even though I know it's a negative, you catch on and you play around with it and you kind of give us that freedom. So again, also very much appreciated. So like that was a fun scene to play out too with like letting that dreading realization of like, oh no, I'm changing because I'm clearly infected like moment from the laptop.
Oh yeah. It's optimal play is boring, both for a podcast and just from a GM perspective. So if I have a player that like wants to make an unoptimal character, an unoptimal decision because it's a more interesting thing to do, I'll be like, yeah, see where this goes.
I love making like role play decisions, even if they're not optimal for my character's survival, because this, it makes the story so much more interesting. So like, I will make those decisions because it's fun and like everybody plays along with it and it works out well. Like I like the role playing aspect of it being like a thing. Like the fact that most of the time I spent my dialogue coughing and like and everybody was just like, yep, nope, that's just the thing. Like that was a lot of fun.
So much of that coughing edited out.
Probably.
There was so much coughing. The coughing that made it in was so much more.
I mean, I got stabbed in the throat. What do you want me to do? It did not get
completely cut. There was a... I kept the track of it because I was kind of curious. I had like 3 minutes of coughing by then. of stale.
By the way, if you want a 3-minute clip of me coughing, it'll be on the Patreon.
I have burned that MP3 file. I printed out and burned it somehow.
But also kudos to the handler, Charlie, for always knowing when to let us graze and chew on some scenes and when to wrangle us in, because I know that we can get real, real distracted or real hyper-focused on a specific thing.
Yeah.
And my favorite of that was, so this monkey thing attaches itself to you. This small monkey thing came out of the box.
Yeah, I think you also wrangled us at some point when I kept trying to go through things in the green box, and you're like, yeah, no, I think you've searched through everything. I'm like, all right. That was a lot of fun.
Green boxes are meant to be explored, but also it's kind of a... Yeah.
We can't keep looking until we get killed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Dad says we're done playing with the stove. It's time to go. It's not so much
that. It's more from just kind of like a pacing perspective. Occasionally, it's time to just move on. Like,
yeah.
The art of editing is an art.
Agreed. Yeah, overall, very, very fun story to play. I look forward to seeing what those other two characters will eventually, if they ever see the light of day, but yeah.
Oh no, I got plans. We're going to do more stuff. Yeah, so like it's for our non-Patreon subscribers, let's explain, let us explain SL. As we kind of alluded to / flat out stated at the start of this, SL exists so that we can kind of play more of the canonical, air quotations, modules from Arc Dream for Delta. As you may have noticed, we do a lot of homebrew stuff around here when it comes to Delta Green. Kind of most of the stuff we play is either what I have chosen as kind of like the pinnacles of the games we play or homebrew, because my logic has always been, hey, anyone can run these modules to a certain extent. Let's give them something that's a little more kind of original at that point, but there is some absolutely fantastic Delta Green stuff to play through, and SL exists for us to do that, which means eventually we will get through stuff like Observer Effect. Yes, Dylan, I'm saying Observer Effect again. Oh,
we're doing Observer Effect?
Not anytime soon, but it's on the list.
Oh, I'm so excited.
Yeah, it exists. We can get through some of that stuff. Don't get me wrong. We're not moving away from kind of primarily homebrew stuff. Our next Delta Green thing will be a return to our long-form campaigns, similar to J-Cell and Hawthorne's Crusade. It will be kind of the ending of a story arc started at the start of J-Cell, or kind of midway through J-Cell, that will come full circle. I'm getting ahead of myself on that. But yes, so we have some agents. We actually talked about kind of drawing agents from a hat at one point, and I'm not sure we're going to wind up doing that anytime soon, because that complicates things. You will see Sanguine again. You will see Star again probably sometime down the line. You probably won't see Snail again because he didn't die the right way for me to do some weirdness with him, but who knows?
You never know in the Negmog cinematic universe, so.
All of you have technically pre-existing offs we could put you on, but die twice.
Question, as we play other SL agents, does that mean, like, is SL like a one singular cell thing? Like, is Sanguine going to be going on ops that I didn't know about until, like, we come back to him and he's like, oh, here, this is what he's experienced? Like, are they acting in the background and whatnot? Or are they going to be kind of in stasis until we come back?
they'll definitely be living their lives, I guess, kind of, and this is some real meta talk at this point. When you are playing a Delta Green campaign, you are probably playing the worst year or years or period of time of your agent's life. Despite the fact that we kind of don't always expand upon how much time is in between operations, Delta Green operations, in theory, aren't constantly happening. Like, that's why Delta Green agents have day jobs they actually have to go to and stuff. That's why they have to maintain covers. Like, there is no full-time Delta Green agent unless you're Miss Pine, apparently. And even she had a day job type of thing, A to main cover and B to probably pay the bills. So I would probably guess that Sanguine's day job is progressing. If he's going on extra ops, that's up to you to a certain extent, I suppose. I had not actually kind of thought about that. There is a inherent nature to Delta Green that maybe you don't call up all the agents in a cell, hypothetically. Also, cells are kind of an outlaw thing, but we choose to use them just kind of as the general catch-all for a group O agents, because I like the name of them, and it gives us fun naming conventions to go with. But we may also cross that bridge as we get to it. But it's also quite possible for Sanguine to go on an op without Star being there, and Star to go on an op without Sanguine being there. And once our extra SL agents are introduced, mix and matching at that point. Maybe once we get through all of them and the remaining ones will enter hat mode and we kind of randomly pull who's going on an op. But at the same time, one of the running jokes in Delta Green is kind of about how, like, oh, it's just a bunch of random agents thrown at something. There is a little curation that goes into who's picked for it. Like, you don't send mathematicians on Last Equation. Or maybe you do.
I love reading the intro to that op, where it's like, if an agent shows up with X amount of mathematics, tell them to leave.
Immediately.
I'm sorry, you're too good at your job for this operation. Goodbye.
We don't want none of your brains around here.
Ignorance is bliss.
Is that like the Delta Green motto at that point?
Kinda, yeah.
It depends on who you ask, you know?
What does Filigree think of that topic?
Dude, Filigree just wants to get away at this point. Like, I mean, hell, they moved a couple towns over, and they're still moving away. Like, they're never going to go back. Fuck that.
That's what you think.
Oh, I mean, if the job calls for it, I'm sure, but...
See, this is like the end of a movie, right? One of the old classic scary movies where you get away. And the second movie will start with a new main cast, and they're going to start learning about what happened and read your news and, like, or your name in a report, and they're going to send someone to get you.
Yeah.
I mean, like, there's a Delta Green campaign in someone, like, bumping off past friendlies from previous operations or something, tracking them down or something. I don't know. There's something to be said there for kind of your discarded NPC friendlies or kind of temporary player characters. Something I've toyed with in the past, but we are way off topic for Lover in the Ice at this point, so I believe that is now officially our cue to end this, if that's a fair thing to say.
I think that's a fair thing to say.
We had a little moment of teasing some other projects.
Hell yeah. Speaking of that, we picked up a bunch of listeners, a bunch of subscribers, and whatever your preferred platform's name for following us is during Lover in the Ice. Welcome. For those not familiar with how this works, we're going to go into a little bit of a hiatus mode now. There'll be some stuff coming out still. We've got Book Club. We've got Beyond the Table. We've got a small break from Delta Green, like I said, for something else. And then we'll be back with some homebrew Delta Green. Whatever we wind up playing will probably be something grim and terrible. But we'll get to that in the future. Keep an eye out for the trailer for that. If you listen to this on the podcast feed part of that, stuff like Book Club and the On the Tables don't always wind up in the podcast feed for a variety of reasons. We kind of keep that space just the actual plays. Patreon patrons, you obviously get everything in audio format. And if you'd like the easiest way to keep track of us, we recommend joining the Negative Modifier Discord. It's on our website, negativemodifier.com, a direct link to that. And leave it down in the show notes, too. If it's not, I'll make sure it's there for this episode. And yeah, come hang out. We talk about episodes and tabletop RPGs. And me and Jad keep constantly posting weird stuff we find on the internet in one channel because it's relevant somehow.
Yeah. Also, we make vague references to old characters that we have to catch people up on the lore on, like the food scientist. But that's from another podcast that Charlie and I did a long time ago.
I will find a way to get the food scientist into negative modifier canon.
We need to make that character canon. Like, there's too much weird shit coming out food-wise that we if there's not a food scientist in negative modifier canon by the time the, like, Mountain Dew Baja Blast pie comes out, then we haven't done our part. Which is, by the way, due to come out later this year.
Nope, we're not talking about that. The real Eldritch horrors of the real world are beyond the scope of this podcast. But on that topic, again, as always, thank you for listening. We do hope you enjoyed our time with Lover in the Ice, and we do hope you will continue to listen to us. Again, thank you.
Thank you all so much. I might see you at the book club. Otherwise, y'all have a good night or day, or whatever time that you're listening.
Yeah. Till next time, friends. For those of you who, you know, said longtime followers, or also for you new time folk, thank you for supporting the podcast by listening and sharing it and doing all that. We very much do appreciate it. You know, it's always nice to hear that people enjoy the stuff we're putting out there. So, yeah, like I said, just thanks for the support. We definitely appreciate it. But yeah, feel free to, you know, pop by into the Discord and say hi, or tweet at us, or whatever, you know, just, we're happy to do it. So.
Yes. Have a good one, everybody. It's a pleasure to have you here.
Also, don't touch that green box.
Or do, and have a good life before you die. Or worse.
Feel the rain on your skin. No one else can touch it for you. Only you can let it in.
On behalf of all of us at Negative Modifier, thank you for listening, and we do hope you enjoyed this episode. If you would like to support the show, please consider rating or reviewing us on your platform of choice, or supporting the show over on our Patreon. In addition to that, if you would like to chat about episodes or with the cast in general, please consider joining our Discord server. Links to all of this and more can be found below in the show notes.